on WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Jackson Rothman with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, May 22nd. Republican State Senator from Bradenton, Jim Boyd, set to be the next president of the Florida Senate, said Thursday he is opposed to the proposed transfer of the USF Sarasota Manatee campus to New College of Florida. In a statement provided to WUSF, Boyd said USF Sarasota Manatee is an important part of the community and has been for 50 years, providing affordable, high-quality education and graduates that local businesses need. Boyd is the most senior lawmaker to take a public position on the proposed transfer. The Florida Senate continues to oppose funding a proposed transfer. The takeover, promoted by Governor Ron DeSantis, supported by the House, would give all of the USF Sarasota Manatee campus buildings and facilities to New College. From the beginning, the House has also supported transferring $22.47 million in state funds from USF to New College. Governor Ron DeSantis pitched a plan to transfer the campus to New College control in December, but did not include a funding transfer in his outline. The Senate had tentatively agreed to the land and facility transfer, but it has not supported taking funding away from USF. The House and Senate are now in negotiations on how to proceed, but appear to be at a standstill. The House has presented their first and second offers during the special session to finalize the budget, including the funding transfer, but the Senate has remained firm on its stance to not include the transfer on their proposals both times. The Senate's position against shifting USF funding as part of the campus transfer now puts them in direct contrast to Governor DeSantis. As drought conditions continue, Florida may choose to ban July 4th fireworks statewide. Agriculture Commissioner Wilton Simpson warned that if enough rain doesn't fall over the state between now and Independence Day, fireworks displays may have to be canceled. During a media conference in Brooksville, Simpson was asked whether people should consider holding off on fireworks shows. Nearly the entire state of Florida is experiencing some level of drought, with extreme or exceptional levels covering most of the peninsula and much of the panhandle. According to a map from the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, all 67 counties are classified as having some danger of fire. Democratic candidate for governor David Jolly says that if he's elected in November, he would establish an office of civil rights within the governor's office. Speaking at a gathering hosted by the Democratic Hispanic Caucus in Fort Myers, the former U.S. representative from Pinellas County took time to reflect on the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling weakening the 1965 U.S. Voting Rights Act, which has now permitted southern states to redraw congressional maps, potentially eliminating Democratic districts and diluting the influence of black voters. At the event, Jolly said he didn't believe racist policies are history. Democratic State Senator Chevron Jones, who endorsed Jolly for governor in March, backed the candidate at the event, saying a civil rights office was not only needed, but necessary. Although Governor DeSantis has publicly attacked diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in the state, several other specialized civil rights offices continue to operate within the state government, including an Office of Civil Rights in the Attorney General's Office, the Department of Children and Families, and the Department of Economic Opportunity. This has been Jackson Rothman with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, May 22nd.
Program is a rebroadcast of a previously aired episode. We're pleased to bring it back to our listeners.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini. Thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. Longtime Massachusetts Representative Barney Frank, as most of you probably know, as the Frank and the Dodd-Frank bill that tried to rectify the weaknesses in our system that led to the Great Recession, passed away this week. I remember interviewing Frank a couple times as a reporter for a small mass newspaper, and must say he ranks among the smartest and funniest persons I ever had the pleasure of meeting. Rest in peace, Rep. Frank. We still could use your expertise. Meanwhile, the grifter-in-chief has come up with yet the most blatant scheme to transfer taxpayer funds to himself, his family, and his supporters, including potentially pardoned J6 insurrectionists who were convicted of assaulting Capitol Police. Remember during his first term when he bought the old post office building and turned that into a hotel that rented rooms to anyone wanting to meet with the president? How quaint. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my conversation with Thomas Kennedy, a policy consultant with Florida Immigration Coalition, who updates us on the status of ICE enforcement in the state. But first, here's some details of the settlement between the government and the president that also included the unconstitutional guarantee that Trump, his family, and businesses are immune from any IRS audits. U.S. Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche told lawmakers this week that he could not commit to barring money from President Donald Trump's newly announced weaponization fund from going to people who assaulted police officers, including during the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot. Blanche, in his first congressional testimony since ascending to the top of the Justice Department after Pam Bondi's firing, also told Democratic senators that he could not commit to barring any of the nearly $1.8 billion from the settlement going to Trump campaign donors. The Justice Department on May 18th created the nearly $1.8 billion fund to compensate victims of political weaponization to settle a lawsuit Trump had filed against his own government over the alleged mishandling of his tax records. The pool of money will be controlled by Trump allies who can give payments to those who claim to have suffered weaponization or lawfare by the U.S. government. One-page document signed by Blanche and released May 19th said the IRS is forever barred from pursuing any related investigation into Trump or his relatives, including into any tax returns filed before May 18th. In questioning, Blanche denied that Trump set up the settlement fund. He said that the five-member settlement commission, four of whom he'll directly appoint, will act independently, and he argued that former President Barack Obama's Justice Department had overseen a similar fund, though that one was signed off by a federal judge. The president did not direct me to do anything, he said later, adding that the fund's money could be given to members of any political party and is not limited to January 6 defendants. The standard for who will get the money, he said, is defined broadly by those who experienced weaponization. What we're talking about is nothing short of the sitting president of the United States looting from the Treasury for his own gain, Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington State. Do you seriously think this arrangement is appropriate? Since Trump took office, the January Justice Department has soft prosecutions against his enemies, dropped charges against his allies, and seen the core of the nation's top enforcement department drop by 8,500 staff. Blanche, whose appearance was scheduled to focus on the Justice Department's 2027 budget, requested $41.2 billion in federal funding, a 13% increase over the previous year. The over two-hour hearing grew tense at times as Democrats and Blanche sparred over the fund and the department's handling of Jeffrey Epstein investigation. Also underscored near unanimous efforts by Republicans and Blanche to defend the president's agenda. Most Republican lawmakers heaped praise on Blanche for reversing what they saw as weak and vindictive law enforcement from the Biden administration and complimented Blanche for making Americans safer. Senator Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, though, asked Blanche how and to whom the funds would be doled out. Blanche said the commission would act independently and issue quarterly reports to the Attorney General, details of which will be provided to lawmakers. He said anyone could apply and be considered. Collins said the money would come from a judgment fund used for other government settlements. Blanche also said that the money could be given to Republican lawmakers whose phone records were seized by Jack Smith, a Justice Department special counsel who investigated Trump. The acting attorney general also faced questions about his department's handling of the Epstein investigation. He said he would not commit to not recommending a pardon for former Epstein associate Ghislaine Maxwell. Separation of church and state? Not on this president's watch. The Trump administration-backed celebration of U.S. religious heritage this week highlighted conservative Christian leaders' ties to the president. As critics expressed, the gathering did not reflect the country's diverse faith landscape. Thousands of people attended the nine-hour program called Rededicate 250, National Jubilee of Prayer, Praise, and Thanksgiving, for a mixture of popular worship music and speakers from evangelical Christianity and conservative Catholic traditions. The event included video messages from members of the Trump administration, such as Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard. All of them generally stuck to the prevailing theme of the day, touching on the Judeo-Christian roots of the country's foundings and the themes they incorporated into some landmark documents, such as the Declaration of Independence. The event mixed elements of a rally and a religious service where chants of USA broke out in the crowd at times, with contemporary Christian artists like Chris Tomlin leading the crowd in well-known worship songs. President Donald Trump did not record a new message for the occasion or attend in person, although organizers played a video of him reciting 2 Chronicles 7:11 to 22, a recording that was originally released as part of the America Reads the Bible event. Rededicated 250 was organized by Freedom 250, a public-private partnership created by the White House to coordinate the 250th anniversary celebrations alongside federal agencies. We try to have something for everyone. That's really our mission, Freedom 250 CEO Keith Kratch told Reuters. I guess you can't please all the people all the time, but we're going to do our absolute best job. Advocates of church-state separation said the event blurs government and religion. The government-sponsored prayer event is the epitome of exactly what our secular constitution forbids our government from doing, said Ann Laurie Gaylor, co-president of the Freedom from Religion Foundation, in a statement. Critics pointed to the absence of religious groups such as mainline Protestant churches, including Lutherans, Methodists, and Episcopalians. Also not represented were the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Orthodox Christianity, Islam, or Buddhism. More than a quarter of all U.S. adults identify as religiously unaffiliated, according to figures from the Pew Research Center. About 23% and 19% identify as evangelical, Protestant, and Catholics, respectively, and about 11% as mainline Protestant. But for the May 17th participants, the event marked a day to connect with others and their Christian faith. Michelle Fenske, in her 60s, said she bought her tickets to travel from her home in southern Oklahoma 2 days after Trump announced the event. "This is what I needed," she said. "It's been a hard few years for our country." Among the political speakers, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson and Republican Senator Tim Scott appeared in person. In a prayer, Johnson decried sinister ideologies that view U.S. history through the lens of our sins rather than seeing God's blessings. "We remember that your mighty hand has been upon our nation since the very beginning," Johnson said. One of the speakers, National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference leader Samuel Rodriguez, said in an interview ahead of the event that the mostly Christian speaker list reflects what American colonies looked like after the Great Awakening, religious revival of the 18th century. That event was one of 16 planned by the administration for the 250th anniversary of the United States. According to the event's website, it is meant to give praise to God for 250 years of his providence for the United States and praying that God bless and protect America for the next 250 years and in solemnly rededicating our country as one nation under God. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Black leaders are asking black athletes to avoid colleges in southern states, limiting minority voting power. The NAACP and congressional black caucuses are calling on black athletes and fans to boycott the athletic programs of public universities and states that are taking steps that the nation's oldest civil rights group says are restricting black voting rights. Launched this week, the NAACP's Out of Bounds campaign urges current and prospective black athletes and their families, alumni, and fans to withhold athletic and financial support from major public universities and states that have moved to limit, weaken, or erase black voting representation. If black athletes participated in the boycott, it could deplete rosters for powerhouse football and basketball programs across the Southeastern Conference and Atlantic Coast Conference. The NAACP campaign calls out Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, and South Carolina as states to boycott, arguing that the athletic programs of those states' major universities are especially reliant on black athletic talent and should protect black political interests. NAACP President Derek Johnson, during a news conference in front of the U.S. Capitol, accused Republican-led southern states of seeking to reinstitute a sharecropping reality by recruiting black talent, black athletic talent, to play for flagship universities while limiting, in his view, our ability to elect candidates of our choice. The ACC, SEC, Florida State University, University of Alabama, four historically black colleges and university conferences, and chapter members of the National African American Athletic Alliance in Texas and Florida did not return the Associated Press's request for comment. The NAACP is among the groups responding to a wave of redistricting in the aftermath of U.S. Supreme Court ruling that winnowed a key provision out of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Johnson repeatedly noted that black athletes have been a core engine of the college sports business, which drives billions in TV deals, revenue, and reputational prestige. Black athletes should not be asked to generate wealth, prestige, and power for state institutions while those same states strip political power from black communities, Johnson said. We will fight and we will have in solidarity with the Congressional Black Caucus to ensure that we have representation, or if we don't, we will withhold the talent that plays on the football field or on the basketball court, be they male or female, Johnson told reporters. The boycott is part of a coordinated effort by black political leaders and civil rights activists to dissuade Republican-led states from redistricting longtime majority black congressional districts. Civil rights activists have mobilized across the South to protest moves by state legislatures to change their maps, while voting rights groups and Democratic lawmakers have filed lawsuits seeking to block potential changes to the districts. And on Monday, the CBC said that it would unanimously oppose the SCORE Act, a bill backed by major athletic conferences that would set new rules for the payment of college athletes unless the sports leagues oppose the redistricting efforts of GOP-led states. The Congressional Black Caucus believes institutions that profit from black talent and black opportunities and black communities have a responsibility to stand with those communities when their fundamental rights are under attack, the CBC said in a Monday letter to commissioners of the SEC and ACC athletic conferences, as well as NCAA President Charlie Baker. Silence in the face of injustice is not neutrality, it is complicity. After the caucus commencement, the SCORE Act was pulled from the schedule of the House committee overseeing the bill. Clark said the decision showed that silence from our institutions in moments of justice carries consequences. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said the boycott was meant to oppose a dramatic return to racially oppressive Jim Crow-like tactics. He added that while athletes ultimately had to make individual choices, they would be supported by lawmakers and civil rights leaders in their decision-making process. We're going to support them, and we know they have options, Jeffries said. The state's trying to make using a surrogate birth mother illegal. A legal battle regarding surrogacy is unfolding in Florida and is quickly becoming one of the most closely watched reproductive rights cases in the country, especially for LGBTQ families who rely on surrogacy, IVF, and other forms of assisted reproduction to have children. At the center of the controversy is Florida Attorney General James Uthmeer, whose office has intervened in a confidential surrogacy case involving a married same-sex couple from France. According to the report from the Miami Herald, the Attorney General's office has argued that surrogacy is comparable to slavery and human trafficking, a position that reproductive rights advocates warn could dramatically reshape family law in Florida. What started as a routine surrogacy proceeding involving two expectant fathers has now evolved into a legal fight that reproductive rights advocates fear could ripple far beyond one family. The couple had contracted with a Florida surrogate and petitioned for early parental recognition before the child's birth. While the judge approved the order, Broward County Judge Marion Marlin Weiss also raised constitutional questions about surrogacy itself. Weiss suggested in his opinion that if unborn children are legally entitled to personhood, then they cannot be subject to contractual agreements. To advocates and legal experts, the implications stretch far beyond one courtroom battle. For many LGBTQ couples, surrogacy and IVF are not luxury options. They are often among the few available pathways to parenthood. Critics for Attorney General's position fear that Florida's courts accept these legal theories, the consequences could extend well beyond surrogacy arrangements involving same-sex couples. Attorneys involved in the cases reportedly say the arguments could affect sperm donation, egg donation, embryo donation, and certain IVF procedures. There are also concerns that adoption protections and parental recognition laws could eventually face new legal challenges. The possibility prompted strong criticism from Equality Florida, which warned that the legal effort threatens reproductive freedom and family stability across the state. Family is defined by love, not by Attorney General Uthmeer's campaign strategy, said John Harris Maher, General Counsel and Public Policy Director for Equality Florida, adding, politicians have no business intruding because parents turn to surrogacy and IVF to start a family they've desperately dreamed of. Equality Florida described the Attorney General's arguments as inflammatory and deeply offensive, warning that they could destabilize decades of established family law protections. The organization also emphasized that although the current case involves a same-sex couple, the broader implications could affect countless Floridians regardless of sexuality. This is part of a broader and deeply dangerous effort to dictate who gets to build a family, whose families are recognized under the law, and who deserves the freedom to parent their children, Maher said. The group further argued that children born through surrogacy or IVF deserve the same legal protections and family stability as any other child. The surrogacy dispute is unfolding against a larger national push by conservative lawmakers and activists targeting reproductive rights and LGBTQ protections. In recent years, anti-abortion legal theories surrounding fetal personhood have increasingly intersected with debates over IVF and assisted reproduction. If courts determine that embryos or fetuses possess the same constitutional rights as born children, legal experts warn it could create conflicts involving abortion access, fertility clinics, and surrogacy agreements. The issue gained national attention in 2024 after the Alabama Supreme Court IVF ruling classified frozen embryos as children under state law, temporarily disrupting IVF services across Alabama. Now advocates fear Florida could become the next major battleground. Uthmir, a close ally of Ron DeSantis, has publicly criticized surrogacy before, comparing it on social media to human trafficking and calling for stricter oversight. While he has not publicly called for an outright ban on surrogacy or IVF, critics argue that the legal theories being introduced could effectively undermine both. The case is currently pending before Florida's 4th District Court of Appeal. The child involved still remains with the fathers and is not expected to be removed from their care. Still, advocates say the larger legal precedent is what matters the most. Bowler's rearing its ugly head again. Hope this administration is up for the challenge. U.S. health officials announced steps aimed at reducing the risk of Ebola in the United States amid international concerns over a new outbreak in Congo, even as it told the Americans the immediate risk was low. On May 17th, the World Health Organization declared the outbreak a public health emergency of international concern. It involves the Bundibugyo virus, a species of Ebola for which there are no approved virus-specific therapeutics or vaccines. Who said the spread doesn't yet meet pandemic levels? The outbreak is suspected to have killed around 80 people in recent weeks, with 8 cases confirmed by laboratory testing and 246 suspected cases reported in eastern Congo's Ituri province. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said on May 18th it had introduced measures aimed at reducing the risk of Ebola in the United States, including enhanced screening and monitoring of travelers who are in or left Congo, Uganda, or South Sudan during the past 21 days. The measures would not apply to U.S. citizens, U.S. nationals, and lawful permanent residents, according to CDC's statement on its order, which is in effect for 30 days. The day before, the CDC said it had activated its Emergency Response Center and was coordinating with interagency partners and providing an in-country support for surveillance and contact tracing, among other prevention measures. On that call, Dr. Satish Pillai declined to answer multiple questions from reporters asking whether any Americans have been exposed. Pillai said individuals are at risk of transmitting Bundibugyo virus when they're in contact with someone who's symptomatic. He added that identifying those infected, ensuring quarantine or isolation, and providing supportive care are the most critical public health interventions right now. Ebola spreads through bodily fluids from an infected person or contaminated objects, and animals can spread it to people, according to the CDC. A particular concern with Ebola is its contagion timeline, said Dr. Scott Roberts, an associate medical director for infection prevention at Yale University's hospital. Symptoms present up to 3 weeks after contact with the virus. At that point, people experience a dry phase marked by nondescript symptoms of fever, weakness, and sore throat that could be confused for flu or malaria. After about 4 days, the wet phase begins as people become sicker with diarrhea, vomiting, and bleeding. Roberts said this is when people become most contagious and when people might seek care, putting hospitals at risk for spread if they don't have adequate protections in place. The outbreak is highlighting concerns among critics of Trump administration around the country's reduced global public health efforts. The United States previously played a key role in surveilling emerging outbreaks, but withdrew from the World Health Organization under President Donald Trump. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Stay tuned to hear my interview with Thomas Kennedy, policy consultant with the Florida Immigration Coalition.
I'm Lou Larini, and I'm happy to welcome Thomas Kennedy, a policy consultant with the Florida Immigrant Coalition, which is a grassroots movement led by a diverse membership throughout the state, including community organizations, farm workers, youth advocates, lawyers, union members, and more, fighting for the rights of all immigrants. Hey, thanks for making time for us today, Thomas. How you doing?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm okay. And yourself?
Great, great. You know, hey, Thomas, you know, tell us just a little bit about yourself and, you know, how you came to work with FLIC.
Sure. So I'm an immigrant from Argentina. I was actually came here undocumented. Came here with a tourist visa, overstated. I was left undocumented for around 15 years or so. And when I graduated high school, I couldn't go to the university. I couldn't really find a job. I was just nervous about my long-term prospects. So I got involved with Florida Immigrant Coalition because they were advocating for young people like me to have a path for citizenship. And over time I stayed involved and ended up working in advocacy.
Great. You know, have you been able to achieve legal residence?
I have over time. Yes, I married my partner.
That's a familiar route. I know that's how my father became a citizen. He married my mother, but that was a long time ago. So, all right. We've got the World Cup coming up, you know, the international soccer championships that are coming to the U.S., including games that are going to be held in Miami. New DHS head, Mark Wayne Mullins, it's a mouthful, has said ICE will be present, but not to round up undocumented immigrants. What should World Cup visitors know to be safe and avoid being detained, as well as people working on those events?
I mean, I think it depends on a case-by-case basis and a circumstantial, right? I think a traveler with a valid tourist visa is more protected than actually a fan living in Miami who's undocumented. That being said, you know, we've seen cases of people with valid tourist visas, such as the case of two Mexican nationals that were in Central Florida that were stopped by the police, who ended up at Alligator Alcatraz for weeks, and the Mexican government had to intervene to have them repatriated back to Mexico. And again, they had valid tourist visas and still ended up there. We've got people with asylum who have been detained at Club World Cup events. For example, a father with his family who was flying a recreational drone in the parking lot before the game was stopped and taken to a detention center. Ended up in that situation, right? So, again, I think it's all circumstantial on a case-by-case basis, but the reality is that we are living under a period of enhanced immigration enforcement. We are living in a period of enhanced vetting and you know, customs checking when one comes into the country from abroad, whether a U.S. citizen or a tourist. So, you know, what we're telling people is just to be aware of these dynamics, these cases, and to, you know, make a determination whether you know, traveling to the World Cup is worth the risk at this time, which, you know, it very well might be, but it very well might not be for a lot of people. And then there's, of course, just like the domestic population, right? Especially now in a context like South Florida, where people have all sorts of immigration status, TPS, asylum cases, legal permanent residents, refugee status, U.S. citizens, who might be left vulnerable due to the enhanced security, law enforcement practices, that are required under an event like the World Cup. And our ask is that, obviously, we understand that there's a counterterrorism component, there's a law enforcement, there's a public safety concern that's valid, but that doesn't mean that immigration enforcement is required to be a component, when ensuring public safety for an event like the World Cup.
Yeah, ICE, which was still funded during the past government shutdown, while other DHS agencies, notably TSA, airport security, were funded. DHS head Mullen recently complained that the agency could not be as proactive in its mission to deport immigrants because of lack of funding. You know, did Florida see any drop-off in detentions?
Did Florida see any drop-offs in detentions, and during which period again?
Well, during the period of, up to the present, when the government was, shut down, for a while.
Yeah. So nationally, back in February and March, the detainee population nationwide actually ballooned up to 72,000, which is the highest ever ICE detainee population in history. Now it's actually lower. The sites have been decompressed, and the detainee population is around 60,000. That's because of a myriad of factors. The government shutdown, the removal of Kristi Noem from DHS, the DHS secretary position, the political context heading into the midterms. It's seen these sort of out-of-control immigration enforcement practices grow immensely unpopular. The overcapacity at detention sites, the expensiveness of these detention sites. So, I talk about Alligator Alcatraz here in Florida. There's a lot of controversy and rumors of a possible shutdown because we spent over $1 billion, in less than a year on the site. We have seen less detentions, but we're still seeing a whole lot of them, and we're still seeing an exorbitant amount. Just because we've decreased from an already exorbitant amount doesn't mean that what we're seeing is still not out of control.
Do you have access to recent numbers like how many people get detained, say in a week or so, or the last couple of weeks? I mean, is it accountable or accountable, I should say?
I don't have that short-term figures, but what I can tell you is that the Miami ICE field office is the highest reporting field office in the country in terms of number of arrests. And the New York Times did an investigative piece about this. And there's a state dashboard tracking state agency immigration encounters. That means deputized agencies like Florida Highway Patrol, sheriff's offices, local police departments, and the highest entity that is the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, especially Florida Highway Patrol. But in terms of cities, it's actually City of Miami that's recording the highest level of immigration encounters.
Yeah, I happen to look at that website, Deportation Tracker, and they've listed it about 34,000 to date, I guess, out of Miami, and break it down, I guess, between people who have been, detained because they have, some sort of criminal issue, or just stopped and detained because, they wanted to. Does that make sense to you?
Well, people get detained for all kinds of things. Racial profiling, loitering, minor traffic violations, et cetera. The problem is that I mean, we just saw, for example, the Marshall Project had a very viralized story about a man who called 911 seeking help and ended up in ICE detention because his immigration status was questioned. So there's a lot of different situations and contexts in which people end up under detention.
Yeah, and you did mention that you know Highway Patrol, I guess, has got the highest number, and that of course is related to those 287G authorized police to operate sort of like immigration agents. Is that still the way most people are getting rounded up here in Florida through local law enforcement?
Yeah, and I actually just shared a video on my social media that was sent to me of an ICE officer riding shotgun inside a Florida Highway Patrol car today in Fort Myers. But they don't even need to have the ICE officer ride shotgun, right? I mean, they are themselves deputized to the immigration agent. So every time they pull a person over on the highway or on the road, they are empowered to ask for immigration status. In fact, some 287G agreements in the state of Florida explicitly empower the officer to drive the person to a detention center without booking them. They don't even have to go through a county jail to issue what's called an ICE detainer, which allows ICE to go pick up the person at a county jail. They can, for example, Florida International University, where I am a doctoral student, our campus, our university police signed a 287G agreement that explicitly empowers our university police to detain someone, check their immigration status, and make a in-the-field determination on whether they need to drive that person straight to a detention center like Alligator Alcatraz.
Unbelievable. And I know
a bit nutty.
I know of at least one sheriff, Grady Judd in Lakeland, to try to get over the try to get past, the issue that they're racial profiling, claims that now anytime they stop anyone, they ask them if they're an American citizen, who they are, But there is still racial profiling. I mean, if you have a deep tan, you better have your papers.
Well, that's the problem with sort of immigration enforcement practices, that are so broad and indiscriminate and invasive. They end up affecting the broader population. They end up affecting U.S. citizens. They end up being incorporated into intrusive government practices. One could say even authoritarian government practices. I mean, Grady Judd, because he doesn't want to get sued for racial profiling, he just says, we're just going to become a show-me-your-papers police force. And we're going to ask everybody to show their papers. I know you have, and maybe some people say, I don't mind that. But a lot of people are sure as hell don't like being asked to, show their proof of citizenship, their papers. So you show me your papers. That's not the country that I want to live in. That's not the country that I thought this was when I grew up here.
Another interesting question, and I know even before all this started, I talked to several people who are also members of, focus more on farm workers like the Apopka Workers Union, and everybody talked about how, people were scared and they weren't going to work. Are we finally starting to see some drop off of important labor that, immigrants perform here in the United States, documented or not, is farm workers having a problem, or farmers?
I wouldn't say we're just starting. The Florida Office of Economic and Demographic Research, this is a state agency, this is a state department. They put out this report called the Florida Economic Overview Report. And in 2025, I don't think the 2026 one's out yet, but the 2025 one talks about the underperformance of our labor market, right? It talks about worker shortages, right? And they attribute that to demographic trends, actually, to the fact that younger people are moving out of the state as retired people move in. It has to do with the cost of living crisis, right, the unaffordability of the state. It talks about death rates and birth rates, the fact that, more people are dying in Florida than are being born. And that's leading, to, of course, labor participation shortages And the state of Florida's own Office of Economic and Demographic Research says the way to alleviate this is through net migration into the state. And that's whether through international migration or interstate migration, right? But unfortunately, the state of Florida has not fomented that. In fact, it has spooked both migration from people with legal status because of the unaffordability of the state, but also people, you know, that might be migrating and hoping to adjust their status or regularize their status or whatever. They're afraid to come here, you know, and that's, again, led to shortages in industries like agriculture, you know, where we're no longer really an agricultural state. We're certainly not the way we were 20, even 50 years ago. We have shortages in the hospitality sector, in the healthcare sector, particularly with elder care, nursing, construction, the service industry, et cetera. So, yeah, we see these. There's a lot of factors that are affecting our labor market and our economy in Florida, but the anti-immigrant policies, I don't think, have helped alleviate any of the current problems that we have.
Yeah. For those just tuning in, I just want to remind you, you're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Tomas Kennedy, policy consultant from Florida Immigration Coalition. Yeah, you know, I'm also curious, too, you know, I mean, if you're privy to any numbers, you know, there was the government or this particular administration, you know, was talking about how they were trying to get people to self-deport, and it seemed like there were a lot of people that were self-deporting. Is that a trend that's continuing?
I would say so. I mean, I wouldn't say it's in mass, but it's certainly more than it has been in the past. I think a lot of people have decided to leave, to not risk ending up in a detention center. But, you know, I think the majority, I don't think it's like a statistically significant number. I think most people are just, you know, seeing it through and seeing how they can weather the current moment. Because, they made their home here. They have family, they have their kids, they have their friends, they have their career, their job, their house, their car, their belongings. You know, so they're not going to easily be uprooted, you know.
Yeah, you know, and that, of course, brings up the other real question, is that, you know, you hear so many stories about people, going to the hearings or trying to follow the process according to the law, you know, to become legal citizens, you know, and getting rounded up there. What's going on with the process? You know, you would think, that this administration's complaint about all these undocumented immigrants would cause them to want to get them documented and increase the number of, immigration judges and courts, you know, to allow the process to continue. Is any of that happening? I mean, you know, isn't it still really hard to get a hearing?
I mean, the opposite, you know, a lot of immigration judges across the country have been fired, have been let go. And in some cases, they're being replaced by, you know, Trump-appointed hardline judges that are just, you know, throwing sand in the gears. But, there's been cases where people have filed, processes within USCIS and paid for the U.S. government, and the U.S. government has pocketed millions of dollars worth of these funds without, getting back to the applicants. You know, they are, again, throwing sand in the gears, sabotaging legal avenues, legal processes for people to try to regularize their status because they don't want any migration. They don't want unauthorized migration. They don't want legal migration either, and that's obvious. And they've said so themselves. The administration has said this.
Yeah, you know, which always puzzles me because, you know, as you accurately pointed out, you know, earlier in the interview about how, you know, Florida needs these people. You know, I mean, when you look at the balance of people, you know, coming to the state, legal or not, you know, from outside of the country or inside of the country, you know, Florida's losing more than they're gaining in workers. You know, and mm-hmm. You know, eventually it's going to be a problem. So, you know, you got to wonder what they're thinking.
I mean, I think it's mostly motivated by racism, to be honest. You know, I don't think this is and DeSantis has said this. You know, he said that when he passed that law called SB 1718, which was sort of like a big anti-immigrant omnibus package that established stricter E-Verify mandates when hiring workers. And, you know, a lot of people in the agricultural community and construction community said, look, we get it, but there's a lot of, you know, there's just not enough, people are not applying to these jobs. You know, where are we going to hire? And he said, look, we don't care if we take a short-term, he called it a short-term economic loss on this, because, you know, we just don't, you know, we ideologically believe that these workers shouldn't be able to work in the United States. You know, they're not legally allowed to be here, et cetera. You know, and I disagree with it. That's a case you can make. But the reality is that at some point, crops need to be, you know, picked before they rot. Things need to be constructed. Buildings need to be built. Places need to be staffed. And workers need to work. People need to make a living, right? I mean, this isn't just a one-way street. And the economy suffers from this, you know? And these people are just willing to sabotage, destroy industries, destroy the state, really, because of just their political vision and their racism and their, you know, their anti-immigrant ideology.
Yeah, you know, and here in Florida, they're coming up with new ways to make it, I guess, even more difficult by, changing the way people get driver's licenses, that now all driver's license tests have to be only in English, you know, when, you know, we know that we're a diverse community. There are, like, lots of people that speak lots of different languages, you know, and that doesn't make them any less able to drive, you know. I mean, but it's going to make it harder for Hispanics, especially since the main way they're being focused on is by traffic violations, you know, I guess.
Yeah, and just, you know, adding to that, right now the Florida Department of Education is proposing a rule to ban undocumented students from attending community colleges. Without any public benefit whatsoever, they have to pay as, not, they don't just have to pay, they have to pay as foreign students, meaning they have to pay 3 to 4 times as much as a U.S. citizen, actually. But the Florida Department of Education is saying, you know what, even if they pay as foreign students, we don't want them to attend. And this is after the state of Florida tried to do this via legislative action. They tried to pass this in the Florida legislative session. And the U.S. Senate rejected that bill thoroughly. I mean, they didn't even give it a hearing in committee. And what did the DeSantis administration do? They're trying to do it again through an administrative rule in a sort of a backroom sort of way. But what's the point of that? You know, I mean, these are students, again, they want to pay. They have to pay. They have to pay exorbitant amounts just to go to school and enter the workforce. But the state of Florida doesn't want them.
Well, you know, also, too, though, you know, and this was, of course, controversial, and you brought it up earlier, and I've tried to get, some more reporting on whether this is going to happen, but, you know, apparently, you know, Alligator Alcatraz is going to close pretty soon, you know, and mainly because it was just too damn expensive, you know, for the state of Florida. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but I'm not concerned, you know. I'm not worried. Now they're talking about, you know, coming up with the giant warehouse detention centers, which, you know, they can put people in without due process, unlimited amount.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, you know, which all seems unconstitutional.
Right. Yeah, yeah, and it's also just an exorbitant, preposterous amount of money going into this, right? I mean, remember, the big, beautiful bill that was passed last year gave ICE $170 billion worth of funding, right? I mean, ICE right now has more funding than the U.S. Marines. You know, a lot of people don't notice. And again, a lot of this money is going into these detention facilities, these warehouses, these containment centers. I mean, not here in Florida, where Alligator Alcatraz is being funded by Florida's Emergency Response Fund for most of the price point. But yeah, I mean, this is just an enormous amount of money to create an increasingly militarized rogue agency that serves at the pleasure of the president and building this sort of network of detention sites across the country. You know, to talk about unconstitutionality, people should think about that.
Yeah, and they should also think about where else those resources could be used. Not the least of which is helping people get health care, or helping people afford a new house or even an old house.
Yeah, even here in Florida, you know, we're talking about Florida's Emergency Response Fund, right? Within $1 billion, $1 billion that went to Alligator Alcatraz. I mean, those are money again for natural disasters, right? Hurricanes. But right now, we're seeing Florida experience a historic drought season and recurrent wildfires in the Everglades, right? That are spinning out of control day in and day out for the past 2 months. You know, there's especially this month, there's been one wildfire after another here in the South Florida area, you know, in the edge of Miami-Dade and Broward. That's money that should have been spent from Florida's Emergency Response Fund to remediate and prevent these sorts of wildfires, to treat them, et cetera. And instead, it's been spent on contractors and vendors at this detention site, right?
Yeah. On that note, Thomas, you know, I'm running out of time, but I also want to add, you know, we'll see how smart that seems spending that $1 billion in Alligator Alcatraz if this hurricane season, isn't as easy as it was last time. So thanks again, Thomas Kennedy, for making time for us today. Okay?
No, thank you for the invitation. Good talking.
You know, yeah. Tell my listeners. Keep up to date about this important issue. Through Florida Coalition of Immigration Coalition. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you can find us on FloridaImmigrant.org. That's our website. Or you can just look us up on really any social media, Instagram, I mean, TikTok, et cetera, and Florida Immigrant Coalition. So you guys can connect us with us that way.
Thanks again, Thomas. You have a great day.
No, thank you.
Manatee County Commissioners passed a motion this week to allocate $100,000 in discretionary funding to the restoration of the old Memphis Cemetery in Palmetto. It was discovered last week that 17 grave sites at the historically black cemetery were desecrated, including broken burial vault lids, cracked concrete, and spray-painted headstones. While county officials believe the damage was done months ago at the neglected grave site, there was an ongoing investigation into the vandalism, according to county meeting records. Speaking during the public comment at Tuesday's meeting, resident and activist Peyton Huey also called on county leaders to call out the racist motivations of the incident. Trump was spray-painted on various graves, making this a clear attack that was politically motivated, and I feel we must elevate that, Huey said. I want to share that no family deserves the pain of seeing their loved one's final resting place spot desecrated. Betty Sales Rhodes, who said her mother and brother are buried in the old Memphis cemetery, thanked commissioners for taking the issue seriously. I was very upset with what I saw. The cemetery, it's terrible, and I want to applaud you for taking care of that, she said. Community members and county leaders agreed that the cemetery's neglected state goes beyond this recent act of vandalism. Commissioner Amanda Ballard, who reported the vandalism to the Manatee County Sheriff's Office on May 12th and filed the motion to allocate the funds for restoration, said the county could be doing more for the long-term preservation of abandoned grave sites. Under Florida statutes, local governments are allowed to provide good faith assistance in securing or maintaining abandoned cemeteries without taking formal ownership. In Manatee County, that includes Old Memphis, Adams and Rogers cemeteries, according to a 1988 ordinance. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota.